Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Cambridge Savings Bank. CSB is committed to improving the financial well-being of local small businesses through financial education and banking services. Learn more at cambridgesavings.com. Member FDIC.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Egan, live from our GVH studio at the Boston Public Library. In an unlikely part of the United States, states are having their Katrina moment, I guess you could say. Nebraska, Wisconsin, Iowa are besieged by historic flooding, and the waters are sweeping away farms that have been the family business for generations. It's just another blow to agriculture, which is already hurting economically because of these ongoing tariff wars. Join us to talk about this and other headlines at the intersection of food policy and food culture is Corby Kummer. Corby's a senior editor at The Atlantic and an award-winning food writer and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition and Policy. Hello, Corby Kummer.
Well, hello there.
Hello, Corby Kummer. So I want to start by quoting the Washington Post food writer Tom
Sitsuma,
thank you very much.
We had him on. Remember, we were watching him for the inauguration.
Great.
Yep.
So he talks about this restaurant called Out of Control that he has visited, and it's introduced readers to tempura battered deep fried cheeseburgers that ooze brie cheese when cut in half, 15-pound ice cream sandwiches, cookies the size of hubcaps, and a meter-long bratwurst with a choice of two sides. He's talking about the excessive size of servings, not just at the Out of Control restaurant, but in restaurants all around the country, and thinks it has a lot to do with why we're all getting so fat.
So my esteemed colleague Tom Sitsuma of the Washington Post is from Minneapolis, and he's pointing to a Minneapolis website that collects these disgusting, out-of-control-sized portions, and then is talking about I eat out. I'm a restaurant critic in Washington. 10 meals a week. I'm wasting a lot of food, including the boxes I keep in my refrigerator and never eat. So this is, of course, what dietitians tell you, like my colleagues at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition. If you're going to get an entree, assume it's twice the size that you should be having and that you're going to take home half of it. Now, I want to ask you, too, how often do you take it home? And then, bonus question, how often do you actually eat it?
Well, the answer is never, because I eat it on the way home. So it never makes it out of the car. So that's a stupid question.
The Italians have the best expression, which is, it won't see the dawn.
That's great.
That is great.
That's pretty good.
But can I tell you something? You know, by the way, I am obsessed with portion control. This piece here is that there are two horrible negative impacts that both of you have mentioned. One, we're one of the fattest nations on Earth, in part because the portions are ridiculous. And two, the food waste, obviously. I mean, the worst example of this, I don't mean to pick out anybody, is, what's the name of that joint? Cheesecake Factory, where literally you order something and it's enough for your family and the people next door. And you should take it home. But you know, it seems to me that in this country, for the most part, restaurants are at one extreme or the other. I know that's a generalization. Obscenely large, or you go to like a high-end sushi place and you need a microscope to be able to see what it is you're paying $22 for. So why isn't there a saner approach to portion control, even if you don't care about how fat America is and if you don't care about food waste? I don't understand why it's gotten out of control.
So first of all, the one that got out of control is because it was just as cheap because of subsidized foods, because of farming practices, to offer double-sized portions for the same amount of money. That's a big problem at McDonald's. We talked the other week about the fact that even if McDonald's is putting healthier options on its menu, it's also slowly but surely ratcheting up the size of its portions and the sodium and the fat. So bad stuff going on at the same time. There's good stuff. But Tom Sitsuma, his Washington Post column, had some thoughtful suggestions, like pointing to restaurateurs who go dish shopping. What do I mean by that? They actually ask for 7-inch plates, not 9-inch
plates.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, I agree.
Because for a long time, there was this fashion. I'm looking at a restaurant across the street at Lenox. I think it was called Blue. And it had these enormous oversized, what are usually used as service plates. They go underneath your dinner plates. But they were used, because they're so big, but they were using them to make the portions look incredibly beautiful and elegant. And what it led to was ratcheting up the size of portions in a very unhealthy, bad way. So now restaurateurs are just saying, okay, instead of putting it on a tiny plate and calling it a small plate, which you eat too many of and wind up paying too much money for your dinner, even though I like tapas-style stuff, it adds up in every way, in money and in calories. Let's have a dinner plate that's just smaller. It's like a bigger salad plate. And then you'll have just as much food as you want. You won't feel cheated. It'll look like it's filling the plate.
It is the most obvious suggestion. That is exactly right.
One more thing on this. Yeah. He mentions this Gibson's Bar and Steakhouse in Chicago, where they cut full-size pies just into four slices. You're eating a quarter of a pie when you order dessert.
Well, wait a second. You know, you mentioned Minneapolis, where you said your buddy is originally from.
Uh-huh.
Remember when we went to the Democratic? Well, you didn't go to the Republican convention, the Sarah Palin, John McCain convention.
Not.
I did. I went out to dinner with Michael Graham, our former colleagues, and two of our producers at a steakhouse. It's honest to God truth. He ordered and received an 84-ounce steak. I repeat, 84-ounce steak. I've told you the story a million times. You came back to write for the Herald, which cut off your health benefits on a Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock when you were on the air, which is a whole other issue. And he ordered the bacon appetizer. On my honor, when he got it, it was a one-pound single piece of slab bacon. That says it all, doesn't it?
I'm just trying to visualize it, and I'm trying to think, would that look incredibly tempting and like you've gone to heaven? The way I feel that if I had all the money in the world, I would have unlimited sushi. That there's something I feel like, you know, I would just be really rich if I could have all the sushi and sashimi I wanted. And yet, as with everything, and restricted diets, if you are allowed to have as much as you want of anything, you get sick of it pretty fast.
So your view would unlimited sushi. My dream would be to take off my clothes and jump in a bathtub full of mashed potatoes. So everybody's got a different thing.
Other people usually have it with melted chocolate.
Okay,
you
whatever.
Have it with potatoes.
Melted chocolate.
I'll go with yours. I like yours better.
We're talking to Corby Kummer, our food guy. You know, you mentioned the calorie before, and there's this piece we're reading this morning about the death of the calorie. Well, explain to us what the thesis. By the way, isn't it written by one of your colleagues, a Tufts person, Susan Roberts? Or she's quoted in it or something?
Let me tell you, Susan Roberts gets such good press because she does such interesting studies at the HNRCA, which is the Human Nutrition Resource Council on Aging, it's USDA-funded lab right here at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition. So what is she and others saying? Although she's the chief source for this, it's The Economist magazine. It's 1843, it's their fancy long form, and it's this endless long, long piece about the demise of thinking that calories in, calories out are everything. It's still actually a very live and very controversial argument. It was the subject of a cover article in the Tufts magazine just 2 months ago, in which Susan Roberts again was quoted. So what's the point? The point is that just saying that a calorie is a calorie, many nutritionists say, won't help you lose weight because you metabolize it at different speeds. If it's hot, if it's cold, all these things, if you have different gut microflora, your microbiome, if you have a different size intestine, all of these things influence the amount of calories you'll absorb, where you'll process fat, how you'll process fat. Just cutting calories won't cut it.
But it's not just the receiver of the calories, the human being. It's also there are calories and there are calories. Isn't that what we've learned from you and others? They're empty calories. They're non-empty calories.
Sure. The main point of this very, very long 1843 magazine piece of The Economist, in which Susan Roberts is quoted, was to say Wilbur Atwater, an American dietitian, he was a biochemist, in the 1880s and 90s, put these poor Wesleyan students in Middletown, Connecticut, into a basement, and he fed them what he wanted to show how often, how much heat they lost. They were in windowless chambers in a basement for like 5 weeks, and the walls were full of cold water, and they would measure how long it took to heat from their breathing. They would collect and analyze their feces to figure out what they were excreting. Based on that and years of torment for his researchers, he decided that a gram of fat was 9 calories and of carbohydrates and sugar is 4 calories. So an equal weight of fat is more calories. Mm-hmm. And so we all thought, okay, that's fine. We have less fat and we can have more flour, sugar, and other stuff. And then that all got blown to hell when there were dietary guidelines saying lower your fat and do whatever it takes to lower your fat, and everybody got fat.
So is there a consensus or close to a consensus in the nutrition community as to what the guiding principle should be? We know we should eat more plant-based things and fewer animals. But short of that, if the calorie is losing its popularity as a measuring stick, I know there's not unanimity. Is there some sort of consensus on what should be the guiding principle?
There's absolutely not unanimity, but there certainly is less processed food, less added sugar, good. Less meat, better for the greenhouse gases. Less saturated fat may be better for your arteries, but when we get to saturated fat and eggs, you know, we're going to talk about that every 2 weeks because there's a new study, and that's constantly in flux. Nuts, good. Last year, new study said that you actually absorb 20% fewer calories than is on the label because of the way they're digested. So nuts are very good. But how good are they for water? So there are these huge trade-offs. No, there is not consensus. But seeing how you measure and how you digest things is still in flux, and it depends person to person. Eating unprocessed whole foods is better.
Well, we get this whole. We're going to switch order here, Jim, because we may as well go to this Healthier Planet story about the eating the 50 foods, the 50 best foods you can eat. It's an NPR story, and you can go online and get it and get the whole list of the 50 foods, half of which I've never even heard of. Azuki beans, black turtle beans, Fonio, Carass, and wheat, all this
Marjorie,
stuff I've never
you've heard of those kinds of beans. You've eaten those
beans.
Have. They just might not have been labeled as such on the menu.
Okay.
Adzuki beans are really cute and a kind of brick red and little and darling, and they look like they could be decor accents.
Oh.
And black turtle beans are just big black beans, and you've had them in soup. You've had them.
Well, this is the whole list of the 50 future foods. So tell us about this list. And they've got algae, cactus.
It's the World Wildlife Fund in a very unlikely partnership with Knorr, the bouillon cube maker.
Is that how you say it, Knorr?
Well, I think in German, yeah. When there's a K in front of something like Knopf, you
pronounce
both.
So should I be saying Knorr in the United States?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I think that's the way they say
okay,
it.
Okay, Knorr, go ahead.
They've come up with this list of what's best for the environment as well as human health. So EAT Foundation in Stockholm, in partnership with The Lancet, the wildly prestigious English magazine, came up with a whole planetary health diet just in January that it released all over the world. We've talked about it. We'll keep talking about it because it's going to have international influence. And now World Wildlife Fund is muscling in on the act and saying, we're worried about the decline in wild species. Why? Because of deforestation. They're losing their places to live, and there's this shocking 60% decrease in wild animal populations in like the last 10 minutes. What is it?
Since 1970. That is just stunning.
Since 1970. So this is why the World Wildlife Fund is getting in on the act. And what they don't say, here's my extra credit factoid. David Edwards, the guy they quote from World Wildlife, was in charge of all the food and sustainability project for the Prince of Wales Trust. He's English and just a great guy. And then the Prince of Wales is trying to divest his charities as he prepares for kingdom. And so David Edwards is leading this charge for better planetary health by thinking of underutilized crops, especially African ones. One of the strange coincidences of this study is that it quotes an African farmer as saying the problem with all these European companies that export stuff is it's unhealthy, it's bad for us, like bouillon cubes. And in fact, bouillon cubes is a huge market, and who makes them?
Knorr,
which has sponsored this study. But if you read it, what's good for the environment, what's good for planetary health, they quote Sam Katz at the end of it, who must have just gone along because it was nice. And
he was Michelle Obama's person?
It was nice in France. He was Let's Move. He spearheaded that and saying, let me translate this into English for Marjorie, who is not aware of having eaten black turtle beans. Just have beans.
Okay.
They're cheap. They're nutritious. They're better for the environment. They're not harming anybody.
Okay. So let's switch to a story that's harming lots of people, these terrible floods out in the Midwest hitting these farmers that are already been badly damaged financially by the Trump administration's tariffs. What's going on?
So this is one of these, there were lots of stories like this in the past 2 or 3 weeks, because if you've been reading about the floods all through the Midwest and in the South and Mississippi, terrible floods at the end of the winter and beginning of the spring that are devastating farms. I thought that we were going to talk about Nebraska because they're heartbreaking.
Yeah.
End of dairy industry because of floods and losses of land, losses of animals and cattle in Nebraska. But this was a piece that happened to just appear in the Washington Post in Iowa, and it was soybean farmers. So 1/3 of soybeans grown in Iowa were sold to China. Then Trump started his tariff war, and they lost that market, and they're stockpiling them all. But will they find a market for them? They don't know. And there's going to be much less of a crop this year because of the flood. So they're looking at least a year's lost profits, lost income, lost profits. But what I find as devastating as the terrible losses of these farmers because of floods is a farmer in the Silver Spur Bar and Grill in Iowa's Fremont County, population 7,400, said, "We like what the president is doing."
Yeah.
As the farmer sees it, China's been screwing us for years, not just on farm products, but technology. So we can duck our heads, pull our boots on, and get through this. And in the long run, the country is going to be better off.
Well, remember one of our favorite books by Thomas Frank, What's the Matter with Kansas?
Yeah.
In this case, What's the Matter with Iowa? You know, Corby,
well,
one of
also,
the things...
Just one thing. They also talk about this is the worst that they've seen ever in lots of these places, including Nebraska, which raises the issue of climate change really ruining some of these longstanding farms. But no one wants to talk about that either.
That's... Well, I want to talk about it, actually. And I should know this. Are there crops that are... that could replace the ones, you know, like corn and things like that, even healthier ones that are more climate change resistant? And I assume if there are, that there's a ton of research going on, I hope in the government world, but if not in the private sector, about substituting those for ones which are getting destroyed by climate change?
So this is a really good and complicated question. My colleague Tim Griffin at Tufts would be better on it because it's his specialty. But the research mostly is, first of all, for Africa. It is drought-resistant crops and mm-hmm. what will grow on a very wide scale in very arid land. And as far as I know, one of the main criticisms of Monsanto, now called Bayer, because they were bought by Bayer, in Germany, is that they're trying to adapt crops that we know, like wheat and maize, as corn is usually referred to these other growing conditions, rather than saying Picfonio, Marjorie's new favorite crop, spelled F-O-N-I-O, part of the World Wildlife Fund.
I've never heard
Fund.
Of that either.
Nor had I. I didn't
okay,
either.
I hadn't either until
is it
this
delicious?
Oh,
good.
Oh,
like
you know.
We're all going to try Fonio.
Okay.
Because we like saying it.
Okay.
So instead of trying to find uses for that and growing it because it's adapted to these climates, they're trying to re-engineer seeds, and they, at the beginning, give them for free, often sponsored by the Gates Foundation and other places. But the question is, how long will they keep giving them for free? So I don't know that the research is being done in the U.S. to uh-huh. adapt to these new climate conditions.
Do you know who takes Bayer aspirin? The Knorrs. Do you know that?
That's right. They manufacture it.
Thank you
cacti?
Very much.
I mean,
they
cacti.
Dissolve it in bouillon.
Have you ever eaten a cactus?
Cacti, I believe, is the expression.
I've
eaten
cactus pears.
Cacti?
And you've had cactus pears,
I have.
Too. Yeah, they're pink and they're pretty.
Aren't plural of cactus cacti?
I think it's cacti.
Cacti, but I meant, yeah, with an I at the end.
But, you know, the only problem is after you do it, I've had those pears, too. You have to take the thorns out of your gums. It really hurts like hell. Have you noticed that or not?
If you've ever grabbed one from the outside without gloves on, those prickers are incredibly tiny and persistent. They're terrible.
We're talking to Corby Kummer, our food guy extraordinaire.
Okay, let's talk about the dirty dozen of pesticides and how we're all eating them, and it's very bad for us all. I'm telling you, it's
unbelievable. Well, you're the bearer of bad tidings, I'll tell you.
Hey,
you
really did I pick all these ratings? I said we need some comic relief today.
So what's going on the pesticide front? I thought this is one of the fewer we actually tested for this, the FDA or somebody
yeah.
does.
What's
and
going
what this
on
article
is we're
suggests
fluorescent. We light up in the tunnels.
Is we're missing a lot of things that could really do great harm, particularly
yeah.
to kids. What are we missing and why?
So every year there's this dirty dozen list of the foods that even though the EPA, the Environmental is it protection agency?
Protection, yeah.
Yeah, I've been so anti-protection most of the time, especially in the current administration. Even if they classify pesticides as safe, they're not being used at safe levels, especially for infants. So infants are particularly susceptible to pesticide residues. But the point that I really liked in this new report from the Environmental Working Group. EWG does great work on a whole variety of fronts. And in this case, they do this annual survey of what the Dirty Dozen are is, let's worry about the health of the farm workers, because that's what really matters.
Yeah,
yes, of course,
really
babies are enormously important. But the amount of pesticides being sprayed near high schools that are full of Latino students, because that's where the farm workers are. In, for example, California's Central Valley, where strawberries are being raised, that's what's dangerous. The residue in the land by these public schools. And that's what the companies don't care about. That's what the EPA isn't measuring. So they took lots of studies from Latina high school students and farm worker families of young people, not babies, and they saw that they had high and dangerous levels of residue in their bloodstreams, and nobody's paying attention to
that.
Yeah,
and that they were more likely to have premature babies, children with autism, impaired cognitive function, and other neurological neurodevelopmental disorders. I mean, this is scary stuff.
Oh, it's very scary. So teenage girls in Salinas Valley, which is Central Valley and near Monterey, and, you know, sort of romantic, but really dangerous. And as always, strawberries at the top of the list.
Yeah, why are strawberries at the top of the list?
Well, because they're enormously susceptible to fungi.
Oh, fungi.
And they are really delicate. And also because there are so few, as with the Cavendish banana, there are so few strawberry varieties that are widely commercially bred, they're hugely delicate and wildly susceptible to fungi.
Can I tell you something? This conversation with you, and I'm very fond of you personally, was so depressing. When this show's over, I'm going to go order a 12-gallon serving of macaroni and cheese
okay.
at the Cheesecake Factory. So if you're
How about
free,
$140 worth of sushi?
Whatever. Nice to see you, Corby Cummer.
Corby
Thank
Cummer,
you
senior
for your time,
the Atlantic
always.
Award-winning food writer and senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition and Policy. Thank
see you,
Corby. Coming up, we're opening the lines, asking you about the Democrats. Should they move off the Mueller investigation or not? You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, live from the Boston Public Library.